Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am enjoying the snow here in Washington, D.C.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and controversies, Brett Ratner is back, baby. And he's hard at work making a Melania Trump documentary for Prime Video. No, we're not playing Cons and Nons Mad Libs. That is oddly a real headline. Brett Ratner, of course, is the director of the Rush Hour series, X-Men The Last Stand, Red Dragon, the remake of Manhunter, et cetera, et cetera. He's made a bunch of movies. Hercules. He made the Hercules with Dwayne Johnson, I believe. He hasn't directed a movie in 10 years. You know why? Because he got Me Too'd very hard for sexually harassing Olivia Munn and Natasha Henstridge, amongst others. The Los Angeles Times reported back in 2017 that he forced Natasha Henstridge to perform oral sex on him when she was 19, and he was in his early 20s working as a music video director. He very much denies this. You know, the forcing of the oral sex should be noted. He believe he has admitted to this, but, I think he is denied that it was aggressive or inappropriate. He masturbated in front of Olivia Munn while she was delivering food to his office and when she was trying to break in as an actress. There were some other accusations involving aggressive come-ons, et cetera, et cetera. The gist of them being that he was a noted practitioner of, the Hollywood casting couch ethos prevalent in Hollywood at the time and before. He was very into supposedly trading sex for acting jobs, that sort of thing. Very much a boys will be boys, entourage style sort of guy. Obviously, all of this was part of what Me Too was designed to bring to an end. So he has not worked for a while. As a result, he has more or less been blackballed from directing, though he still has a number of producing credits thanks to his company, Rat Pack, which has a number of fingers and a number of different pies. I guess that means he has plenty of time to direct a documentary about Melania Trump for Prime Video. One wonders if Ratner's work here will earn him more scorn from Hollywood. I don't think that that's much of a question. I feel like this is the sort of thing you do, and everyone kind of rolls their eyes and like, oh God, this guy, he's back, and figures he'd be doing something like this. I do kind of wonder if it will help him ingratiate himself into the growing, kind of right-wing conservative film scene that is being championed by the likes of Angel Studios, Daily Wire, other independent filmmakers. Is there even a market for the sort of movie he makes for them, really, particularly at the budget level he is accustomed to working at? I think there is an interesting question to discuss with Melania Trump herself. You know, this was a big meme in the first Trump administration. How dare the fashion magazines not put this literal fashion model on the cover of their magazines when they put other first ladies on there? She's way prettier. She's way more glamorous. She should be on there. And I think this is at least designed in part to kind of counteract that move, that critique, kind of short circuit some of that stuff. I don't know. Make sense to me, because I am not the target audience for a documentary about first ladies, frankly. I don't care. I don't care about them at all. But this does seem like weird. This is a weird kind of collision of interests and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think that it seems very strange if you're looking at it from the perspective of sort of traditional first ladies or, what is the market for this, et cetera. But it makes a lot more sense if you have watched the sort of rise of reality television or the sort of degradation of documentaries as they've become sort of celebrity image making machines. And so you increasingly have, documentaries about musicians that are effectively that are not really documentaries in the traditional sense that, in a filmmaker with access but a certain level of independence is going in to capture, the action behind the scenes and is going to come out with a sort of independent perspective on what's happened here. Instead, I think these documentaries, and I kind of use that in scare quotes, have become sort of a new form of the celebrity memoir. And, you know, I think that once, you know, the Kardashian industrial complex showed how successful that could be, it was really only a matter of time before various famous people decided to effectively move their memoirs into video form. And to a certain extent, someone like Ratner makes a lot of sense for this project, right? He is someone who brings credentials, but is probably, you know, available in a way that,
he's not directing a lot of movies.
Right. Like, he's free. He has time on his calendar. He brings a certain, you know, like he'll bring a certain gloss and polish to the project. It is interesting that Melania Trump, whose own sort of memoir was sort of more of a coffee table book, was kind of panned. It's interesting that a first lady is doing this, but it's not necessarily interesting that a sort of famous woman who kind of feels that she's been misunderstood, has a brand that she maybe wants to kind of rehabilitate, is doing something like this. The thing that I actually find most fascinating is that this has been announced sort of roughly at the same time that Meghan Markle is back on Instagram and is rolling out a new sort of docuseries that is basically sounds like it's going to be like kind of the lifestyle content that's done really well on TikTok and other places, but in like glossy documentary format. And so I'm really, really interested to see what this looks like. Both because Melania Trump, I think, has remained fairly inscrutable to a lot of the American public, even people who, you know, kind of like her, think she's, you know, classy, interesting, presents herself well. She is just really kind of an enigma. And I think there's some perception that she did not particularly enjoy being first lady. Was not particularly interested in sort of the rituals of being first lady. She's sort of coming back to that position again. There's also a lot of like weird fevered speculation. It's like, oh, she doesn't actually love Trump. They're going to get divorced. This is all an arrangement, most of which I find to be sort of nonsensical. But I do think it'll be just very interesting to see how this person who has been very, very sort of reticent to engage with the public presents herself in sort of an increasingly common format. And I would not actually be surprised in, you know, a generation hence if we have, you know, first ladies and first, you know, presidents, etc., who don't do the traditional memoir route at all, but instead do sort of documentaries instead. I think that especially as I just think the standard doorstopper presidential memoir is, you know, that's something that we have kind of come to expect will be part of a post-presidency. And I think that may end up being sort of a fleeting cultural thing that actually is displaced by video in a way that could be really interesting.
Tough times for ghostwriters.
Yes. Yeah.
Those things pay well.
Yes. But maybe a good time for documentarians, especially ones with.
But that's
time
what these documentarians.
These documentarians are becoming
ghostwriters, and you are exactly right to compare this to celebrity memoirs. That's precisely the way to think about this, and to position this in the wave of musicals about celebrities, musicians, and in many cases athletes who have had documentaries produced about them. But you see in the credits, and it's reported. It's clear that either the subject or the subject's family in some cases has essentially final cut, sort of a kind of producer rights over the product because it is for their image making. And I could be wrong about this, but my sense is that the most popular successful version of this and in some ways the documentary that started not maybe completely started, but that really kicked off the boom in this style of of image managed, image making product by somebody who has been on the scene for a while and wants to release a sort of statement about themselves, but not maybe do like not actually be the person to make it themselves, but they're hiring somebody to do it. Was the Michael Jordan documentary, The Last Dance. And that, like, in some ways, this really did provide a huge amount of information about Michael Jordan, took you behind the scenes. There was a ton of footage that was, you know, had never been seen before, plus all of his personal recollections at the same time that was made entirely with Michael Jordan's, not just permission, but like his participation as a, like, and his ability to say, no, you, that's not going to be like that. No, it's going to be more like this if he wanted to. And we've seen, I do not watch many of these, but I have some friends and colleagues who watch a lot of them, especially the music ones. And there's a sort of, these things are a mixed bag because on the one hand, they are very promotional. On the other hand, they do allow you a kind of access to the person, or at least to a part of the person, often to materials that are either rare or never seen before. And so there is a way in which they are letting you in, but they are letting you in to a very curated version of themselves. But that's how all celebrity is now, as far as I can tell. And that is how celebrity, as you talked about Meghan Markle and TikTok, this strikes me as not just a phenomenon that we are seeing sort of with documentaries or these kind of quasi documentaries, but a phenomenon that we're seeing, like, this is part and parcel with the way that so much of our kind of celebrity culture is moving to online video, to TikTok and to YouTube in particular. And that this seems to me like a sort of outgrowth of that. This is a very, I mean, in some ways, this is going to be a kind of extremely professionally produced, just in the sense that Brett Ratner is somebody who has made very big budget hot Hollywood films, right? And there's probably a real budget here. This is going to be an extremely professionally produced TikTok, YouTube feed, right? Like in some sense, right? A tour of Melania is what I would expect, right? But like it's the part she wants you to see.
A couple different things here. I feel like we have to stop calling these things documentaries just on general principle. Like,
what do we call them? We need a word.
I don't know.
Autobiopics
or
that's not bad.
Reality. I mean, like straight up just reality TV. Yeah. Reality biography, maybe. I don't know. There has to be a better term because I don't expect this to be a documentary in the sense of giving us, it's certainly not in the, you know, investigative form, even as like a talking head thing, I imagine it'll be pretty neutered. And you know, look, there, not all of these things have to be hard hitting exposés, right? Like I talked to Stephen Hayden, who was the story producer on this Yacht Rock documentary for Bulwark Coast Hollywood this week. And that's like, that wasn't like a hard hitting investigative documentary, but it was still very interesting and informative. I'm not expecting this to be terribly interesting or informative. The other thing here is I do think it's I don't know. The Trump White House is sui generis in many ways in both the first and second incarnation. But even then, I am shocked that they would want to be affiliated with a guy who was essentially, accused of at best sexual malfeasance, at worst assault against, you know, Hollywood types. And I feel like that is like, is that really the sort of nest the White House really wants to be kicking? Is that like is that the hornet's nest they want to be sticking their hand into? I just think I should not lose my capacity to be shocked by the things that we see. And in this case, I certainly have not, because I saw this headline. And I was like, wait, Brett Ratner, the guy who, got has been essentially kicked out of Hollywood for being a sex pest.
Yeah. I mean, at the same time, isn't a lot of sort of Trump 2.0's brand like a very explicit rejection of some of the newly established social norms around people who've been accused of sexual harassment and sexual assault?
Oh, totally.
One thing we know about Donald Trump and the Trump family is they only surround themselves with like the best, nicest, most competent professional people who have no stains on their record. No, like, right. Like we all know that, like, they're really rigorous about a kind of decency and a kind of law following
which is why Pete Hegseth is going to be our next Secretary of Defense.
Yeah. No, I should not be surprised. I guess I'm not, but
there's just sort of two related things here. One is this is not a new thing for Trump 2.0. He has always surrounded himself with people who are held in disregard by a certain type of polite society, is as neutrally as I can put it, by sketchy characters, right? Has always surrounded himself with sketchy characters. There's also, I think, I don't know if it's quite explicitly stated by anyone who is, say, working in the Trump administration, but there is an implicit movement on the part of the wider MAGA universe to reverse, to go back, like to reject a lot of the kind of social trends, like you guys were saying, that are like related to the constellation of issues of like mid-tens wokeness, right? The big universe of things that might be packed into that word. And this is associating yourself with Ratner, who has all these allegations. So again, we should note that not only has he denied them, there were no charges filed. So at no point was there ever any legal action that was taken to the level of a charge. And what that tells us, you know, make of that what you will. They have always surrounded themselves with people who are at least seen as disreputable.
Sure. I mean, again, I'm not shocked. And look, there are people who got Me Too'd unfairly. And, well, you know, we could discuss that, but like Ratner has never been a name that's been high up on the, like, this guy needs to be rehabilitated for the good of, you know, the arts or anything like that.
Rush Hour 4, you know, if we don't get Tower Heist 2, did they make a second one already?
Sure. I guess these
are going to be great cinematic achievements.
Yeah.
Like that we're missing out on here.
I'm sure it's just a finger in the eye of, you know, kind of polite society, but the whole thing is
Melania
kind of
Trump
amazing.
Really, really likes Brett Ratner movies. I'm like,
that's true. Maybe she is an X-Men: The Last Stand fan. She is a big believer in the first of many terrible Dark Phoenix movies. So I don't know.
The first two acts of that film are better than people give it credit for.
I am a modest defender of that film. I think it got a slightly bad rap, though the conclusion was not very good. All right, so what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that the director of X-Men The Last Stand is making a documentary about Melania Trump for Prime Video? Controversy or non-controversy? Peter?
I guess it's a controversy, but mostly it's just like, what?
Alyssa?
It's an controversy. This is exactly what we should expect of, prominent political candidates and celebrities going forward, although perhaps not with Brett Ratner.
Is your position that things can't be controversial if we should expect them?
Yeah, that's crazy. I think that's why it's controversial. It's controversial because it's not surprising. It's like, what? This is just the standard. This is the next 4 years, next 100 years of our life, the 100 years of solitude of God. Awful.
It's that and more Marvel movies coming soon. Winter Soldier 2. No, the Captain America 4.
I would say that
Brave New World.
Yeah, that's what it's called.
All right.
That's what we're living in, a Brave New World.
Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our discussion of Bloodsuckers on our special members only bonus episode. Speaking of which, on to the main event. Nosferatu. Now, Nosferatu will be familiar to anyone who has read Bram Stoker's Dracula or seen the original silent film Nosferatu from 1922, which was an illegal adaptation of Stoker's work that courts actually ordered destroyed, or if they've seen the Werner Herzog remake of the film, or if they've seen Francis Ford Coppola's feverish Bram Stoker's Dracula. If you've read or seen any of these things, you'll basically understand what's going on in this movie because the plot mechanics are roughly the same in all of them. You have a young couple, in this case, Ellen and Tom Thomas Hutter, who are played by Lily Rose Depp and Nicholas Hoult, respectively, who are newly married in Germany in the 1800s. Thomas is required by his boss to travel to the crumbling home of Count Orlok in Transylvania. He's played here by Bill Skarsgård, to get him to sign a contract. Except, oops, turns out the contract is in exchange for Ellen. Always read what you're signing, folks, even if it's in some weird language that you don't recognize. Of course, Orlok is the vampire, the Dracula, the Nosferatu, the bloodsucker. He brings with him plague, death, et cetera, not just to the Hutters, but to their friends who are putting Ellen up in their home while Thomas is away. Only Professor Franz, who's played by Willem Dafoe here, understands what they are up against. And it's Professor Franz that we hear... it is from him that we hear a statement not only of this film's ethos, really, but the ethos of writer-director Robert Eggers' entire body of work. Here is what he says, quote, "We have not become so much enlightened as we have been blinded by the gaseous light of science, he says. I tell you, if we are to tame darkness, we must first face that it exists." End quote. Now, this translates almost perfectly into modern slang. I can put this into modern slang for you guys. You want me to do it? Here it is. "I will not be gaslit by you jerks into believing that evil does not exist." That's what he's basically screaming that at the audience. And this is the key to understanding not only this movie, but also The Witch and The Northmen, right? Eggers makes movies that adopt the ethos of the time in which they are set. These are films that do not do the winking irony or reject the idea of evil in the world. They are about good and evil, and they suggest that evil exists. In The Witch, you need a witch hunt because witches are real, not because witches are a scapegoat for some other problem. You need witch hunts because witches are real. In The Northmen, we have to accept the idea of, like, not only Nordic mysticism, but also basically the Nietzschean will to power, right? You basically just have this world where slavery exists and kin murder exists, and you just kind of accept it, because otherwise the movie doesn't work, doesn't make sense. And so it is with Nosferatu, which is a movie about the nature of evil. Specifically, in this case, I think it's not just the nature of evil being embodied by Dracula. Like, you don't just have to say, like, oh yeah, sure, Draculas exist. There's vampires out there, and they're gross and bad, and they're evil. This movie does have a kind of interesting subtext, along with all the other iterations of Dracula and Nosferatu that I mentioned above. In this case, it is kind of about the soul-destroying nature of sexual assault. That is really, it's not even really the subtext, it's kind of the text of that opening sequence in which Ellen is, you could say, either seduced or assaulted by the vampire in question. Her connection to him, her waking nightmares, what we might now call PTSD, it all comes back to her abuse as an older child or a young woman at the hands of Orlok. And again, whether we are meant to believe that this was a literal physical intrusion or merely kind of a mental projection across the continent, whatever happened, she has been greatly harmed by it. Evil has been done to her, and everyone will suffer as a result. Look, set all that aside, set all the ethos and the, you know, I just love how this movie looks. It's got this kind of silvery blue darkness that the cinematographer and Eggers have accomplished. There are shadows, there are deep, dark shadows everywhere. Torchlight is used to light many of the scenes. I love how this movie looks. There's this great shot of Nicholas Hoult in a road, basically in a crossroads, and it's just dark all around him, a little bit of snow, and a carriage pulls up that doesn't have a driver, and he's like, I guess I better get into this. It's creepy. Creepy shot. Love it. And I think that more movies should look like this. I love Lily Rose Depp's performance in this. I have argued many times that she has gotten a raw deal from critics who hated The Idol because they did not care for that movie's portrayal of celebrity and, I don't know, modern sexuality and that whole culture. But she's great. She was great in that. She's great in this. Willem Dafoe plays his Professor Franz with the sort of mad glee. He, like, does the whole mad scientist thing pretty convincingly. I love him. It's the movie is I've seen some folks suggest the movie isn't scary. I don't think that's true. It's got a few jump scares to it, but it also just has this kind of general sense of dread and pervasive ill at ease-ness, for lack of a better word. It's a little scary, but not overly bloody, not like constantly shoving jump scares into your face. That's the perfect mixture, as far as I'm concerned. The whole thing is a nightmarish fever dream. So I like this movie quite a bit. It made my top 10 of the year. Peter, what did you make of Nosferatu?
This movie is exquisite. And like you, I loved the way it looked, but even more than the way it looked, or maybe part and parcel with that, it's not just that the images were amazing. It's that the pacing of the images is amazing, is perfect. So Alyssa, who I often see movies with, occasionally hears me complain, often in the summer, that movies are badly edited. Even if the shots are interesting, the editors don't know how to hold on the shots for long enough, or sometimes for too long. But there's just this sort of this like lack of understanding of what you're trying to say and how long to let someone look at a single image. And this movie has just the most precise and elegant sense of exactly how long to let the viewer look at every one of these incredibly gorgeous images, to let the weirdness, the terror, the beauty of it all sink in. And I love that. I just love seeing a movie where there is control of that, of the visual pacing. And there are very few films that I've seen in the last several years that have anything approaching this level, not just of sort of sheer beauty of the images if you take a still, but of that kind of control of where you're, not just what you're looking at, but how long you are looking at it. And it just allows you to sink into the mood and the gloom and the particular the historical particulars here. And this is the other thing that that Eggers brings to all of his films, is one of the reasons that the Witch gained so much attention was it's not just sort of that the movie looks great and is kind of unusual in the way that it treats mysticism and the sense of the supernatural. It's also that it was historically incredibly accurate, down to like the hooks in the walls of the sheds that, you know, or the buildings that he's filming. And here you have this same thing, even some things that you might not think to notice. So there is a scene in which Nicholas Holt's character is heading towards to visit Orlok, and he stops for the night in a gypsy camp, a gypsy town. And so that town has been historically researched like to the hilt. But it's not just the buildings. It's also that Robert Eggers recruited exclusively people of the correct European descent to go and play every one of those gypsies, and also including a bunch of people who specialize in historical gypsy dance and music. And so Nicholas Holt is surrounded by these people, not understanding their weirdness, their traditions, but it's like it's not just something that he's made up to seem strange. It's that Eggers has actually gone and found the people who have carried on these traditions, who still have the same look in their eyes and their faces and their bone structure. And he is putting you in that, putting his characters and putting the viewer in that place in a way that's just not really like anything any other director is doing. So I just loved the way that this movie was made. I think if there was something that put me off of this movie a little, it's that it has this perspective that you talked about, Sonny, where it is a movie about sensing the world in a pre-modern way. And it insists to us that there is this pre-modern way of understanding the supernatural in particular. But in its depiction of that pre-modern worldview, it doesn't quite let you in. It says it's there and I'm going to show it to you, but it doesn't quite allow you to directly experience it. And I think that's not necessarily a big problem, but it's a little bit cold and it's a little bit distancing. And it is kind of funny. Kyle Smith, in his review for the Wall Street Journal, just argued that this movie just comes across as extremely German. like in its sensibility, that sort of like cold, distant, but like with a little bit of black humor, sort of buried, right? Like almost a kind of engineer like worldview. And there is something to that that I both really enjoyed and related to, but also felt was like this movie. I was deeply engaged in admiring it, but I was not deeply engaged with the sort of, I wasn't actually drawn into this world in a way that I found just a little bit, it's cold and it's a little bit alienating in its, in the way that it goes about things. But I, the more I think about this movie, the more I like it and the more I want to see it again.
It sounds like what you're saying is that it was emotionally distant.
Yes. This is not a warm film, and it is a film that portrays a lot of very intense emotions, but from an austere, reserved position.
I mean, there's an extent to which it feels like a meta movie about Eggers' relationship to his audience, right? In the sense that it is about a clash between sort of an emergent and an emergent worldview and the worldview that it's either sort of leaving behind or sort of, in fact, actively superseding. And Eggers, to a certain extent, puts you in the same position as Friedrich Harding, right? Who's kind of rejecting the idea of the evil. And he's just sort of saying, you know, you modern viewers are wrong to discount this, but, you know, and sort of saying like, well, if you can't get it, I don't know. There's something sort of alienated about his work that I find interesting, but not necessarily particularly enjoyable. I do think the best thing about this movie, and I think there's something that we haven't really talked about here, which is the movie's relationship to sort of contemporary depictions of vampirism. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting about this movie is that it preserves the sort of, and in fact accentuates the sort of sexual nature of vampirism while also just making it really, really disgusting, right? Like these are not the sort of hot vampires of True Blood or even sort of Buffy the Vampire Slayer or, you know, any one of a number of, or Twilight. Nobody here is sparkling, right? No one here is sparkler who's really good at baseball, right? Like Count Rolock is like gross and rotting, and the act of vampirism itself is rendered as sort of physically disgusting, right?
Well, almost, I mean, like explicitly as a form of sexual assault. I mean, like the first attack on Ellen is, again, like he is on top of her.
She's and, like, choking.
She's choking. But then when Nicholas Holt's character goes to Count Orlok's mansion, you know, his crumbling Transylvanian mansion, he is also like mounted by Orlok and like, you know, in a way that very and is like Skarsgård plays him kind of like writhing on top of him. Again, it basically looks like rape. Like I don't feel like that's an exaggeration here.
Yes. Yeah. But just, you know, the sort of like a visceral consumptive, like there is not a difference between, you know, Herr Nock like biting the head off a pigeon in an insane asylum and Count Orlok like slurping up the sort of blood and viscera of his victims. It's, you know, it's a very deliberately gross approach to vampirism, which I think is both very effective as in terms of making this a horror movie, but also, you know, serves as sort of a response to the, you know, the very popular sort of sexy vampire trope that has been ascendant in American pop culture for really the past sort of 15, 20 years. And I appreciated that about it. You know, I do think, and this is something, you know, that Richard Brody brought up in his review. And I speak as someone who I feel like I either totally agree with Richard and I'm like, nobody else has said this and I agree with it, or I completely disagree with him. But in this case, I mean, he makes the point that, you know, Eggers is making a deliberate change from the original story and essentially saying that like the way for Ellen to free herself and everyone else is to have sex with her rapist again. And he had mixed feelings about that, and so do I. I mean, again, it's very effective as a form of horror. I'm just, you know, it increased my sense that this was a movie that I'm glad to have seen and just never want to watch again. You know, it is part of the sort of broad, sort of austere unpleasantness of the movie, in a way that is intellectually, even sort of artistically, visually rigorous, like that final shot of like Ellen and Nosferatu and like the lilacs spread over them is, you know, has a sort of H.R. Giger-esque kind of rigor to it that I've thought about that shot a lot and do not enjoy it.
Specifically, it's interesting to compare Nosferatu and The Northman, which I kind of watched in relatively short order, back to back, because Nosferatu has this, it centers this idea with regard to Ellen as a she is a woman out of time, right? This idea of her, there's a line that Willem Dafoe's character has where he's like, in a previous age, you would have been a priestess at the temple of Isis, right? This idea of her connection with the supernatural, with the psychic, the kind of ethereal. But there's also this kind of heroic, this old heroic idea of self-sacrifice, right? Of she is giving herself up to save the world of Germany, you know, they're like not only her friends and family, but also the broader culture in which they're placed, which again is very much in line with The Northman, which ends with a man deciding, you know, spoilers for that movie, I guess, if you haven't seen that, you should. It's good. I enjoy it. But that ends with a character deciding to give up his happy family life and sacrifice himself to give them freedom and safety going forward. And that is, I think, I don't know. I find it deeply moving. Like, I have always been a sucker for tales of self-sacrifice and you know, giving yourself over for the safety of your loved ones. I find it deeply moving and compelling. I don't know.
And it's a self-sacrifice done not by the trio of men who sort of aspire to be heroes, but by the woman who is, who is at the center of this.
Because she's the only one who has the power to do it. I think very explicitly. Again, this tying back to this idea of her as this like almost pseudo-mythical figure, as much as Nosferatu himself is kind of a mythical figure, I find it very interesting. I find the movie very interesting. I thought it was incredibly compelling to look at and experience visually, but also just like intellectually, I find it to be a deeply interesting movie.
Yeah, the whole like pre-modern worldview thing that we've been talking about here, I think is interesting, not just because this is what Eggers is doing, and this movie more than his previous films is explicitly defending that idea, but also because of the movie's success, right? This has been not a gigantic box office hit, but it has done pretty well. When Alyssa and I saw it at the Alamo on a Saturday night in Washington, D.C., it was very nearly full at the biggest screen in the house. And I do kind of wonder if Eggers, who is one of the most talented younger filmmakers making movies today, he is, I believe, just 41 at this point and has now made 4 movies. I do kind of wonder if he represents a backlash to the way that history has been portrayed in a lot of pop culture, film in particular, television, over the past 15 years or so, where there has been this sort of ironic look back on things that is morally judgmental on the past's sins and flaws because of, because they don't live up to our sort of current standards for what's right and correct. And I wonder if we are going to see a movement towards a less judgmental, maybe you can almost call it more neutral, but at least sort of more lived in from the perspective towards portrayals of history that that don't try to filter that history through a modern worldview or modern moral lens.
Well, it's interesting because I don't even think it's a question of judgment, right? So, like, I don't think that... I don't know. I just compare this to Gladiator 2, which we saw and we talked about, right? And there's this big speech in Gladiator 2 about how Rome was designed to be the sanctuary for the immigrant masses to, you know, come in.
Yeah.
And like, bullshit. That's not true. That's a lie. That's a lie. But it is very appealing to the sort of person who tends to write big Hollywood blockbusters. Like, it is. You have to make this place appealing to modern audiences, right? Like, we have to make ancient Rome appealing to modern audiences. Well, how do we do that? Oh, it's a beacon of hope and light and in the world. I guess. I don't know. That does not really feel like what Rome actually was back then. But
and especially the wrong. Gladiatorial slave pits. I mean, there wasn't a. This is not like a. Locus of a great locus of freedom and progress.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Nosferatu? Peter.
Thumbs up.
Alyssa.
Thumbs up in the sense that I think it's exceptionally well made and quite well acted. But I do not want to watch it again.
Thumbs up. I can't wait to buy it on 4K and watch it all the time. Put it on a loop. My house. All right.
You can't wait to buy it on 4K and leave it in its packaging for a year before you watch it one time.
It literally, that's almost how long it took me to watch The Northman on 4K, because I bought it like a year ago because it was on sale. Because you got to get things when they're on sale. You got to tell you save money. But I did not watch it until I was preparing to write my review of Nosferatu. Anyway, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.